Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with my colleague and co-host, Bill Raggio, Senior Fellow of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. And we're very pleased to welcome Seth Frantzman of the FDD, but most importantly, Chief War Correspondent for the Jerusalem Post. We begin in Gaza because over these last days since we last talked to Seth, there have been political decisions made. At the same time, the war fighting is going on, although over a wide front. Last time we talked, we were focusing on Rafah. Now there are other neighborhoods being mentioned in Seth's reporting. Seth, a very good day to you. Gaza continues unsolved. The Hamas are in tunnels or coming in and out of the Sinai or in the general population. There's a new neighborhood, which I'm careful to pronounce, Shavia, where the IDF is now operating. Please help me understand, how many neighborhoods are there in such a small space? And what about operating there? Is this mean that Hamas has re-infiltrated this neighborhood or was always there and it was not a major concern in the initial fighting? Good evening to you, Seth.
Good evening to you. Well, to understand, northern Gaza Strip has, or prior to the war, let's say, you know, had more than a million people or so. It's not just a city. It has a whole bunch of, let's say, suburbs and environs and neighborhoods around it. I mean, it's like if you think about New York City or something like that, extending outwards. So Israel had cut off northern Gaza during the opening weeks of this offensive in October following the Hamas attack. And it had Israel claimed it had defeated most of the Hamas battalions in northern Gaza. That's about 10 or 12,000 Hamas fighters or something. However, from the moment that Israel kind of switched focus from the north to southern Gaza, which happened in December, January, the Hamas began to infiltrate right back into all these neighborhoods. And you mentioned Shajaya. Shajaya is one of them. Shajaya is next to a neighborhood called Jabalia. And that's next to several other ring neighborhoods all around Gaza City. In all these areas, basically Hamas popped up. I think generally Hamas just didn't go away because the sad truth perhaps of the October-November offensive was that Israel went in very heavy with lots of tanks and stuff and drove around on the surface but was not able to get down underground completely to find all of the enemies. So there were all sorts of parts of these areas where Hamas just put on civilian clothes and went and hid in homes and stuff and just waited. They waited a month and they came back. So now what Israel's been doing in northern Gaza is kind of systematically going through these neighborhoods again and again. It's gone into a place called Shati Camp, which is next to the beach. It's gone into Zaytun. It went into Zaytun a few times. Then it went into Jabalia twice. In Jabalia last month, it took 3 weeks to basically grind down what was left of Hamas there, and they found 7 bodies of hostages. So this is now this is the second time they're going into Shajaya. In Israel's estimation, each time Israel goes in, it takes less troops to secure the same area over a shorter period of time. So what that means is, let's say the first time around, it took, you know, maybe 2 divisions or one heavy division to go into a place like Shajaya. Now they can go in with a much lighter footprint of a few brigades or something. And they generally are not facing as much Hamas fighters, but they are still facing Hamas fighters and there are casualties. And the goal is usually to go in and then go root around underground and see what they can find and extend the areas that they had found before in terms of neutralizing whatever's there. It remains to be seen if this strategy works. Israel is set on it. So this is the tactic. I shouldn't have called it a strategy. It's a tactic that Israel has set upon. We don't know where this will be in a year, but this is what they're doing.
Bill, you have a question for Seth.
Yes, Seth. How can Israel succeed if it's allowing Hamas to bleed back into these areas? How is the Israeli strategy to defeat Hamas, or is it to degrade Hamas?
I think that just depends on the definition of success of Israel's leadership. And I think we've seen throughout the war, the political leadership of Israel generally has a slightly different or a different take on the war goals and aims sometimes than the army and the defense ministry. Because, for instance, in the beginning of the war, we heard things like there won't be Hamas in Gaza, in Hebrew, of course, but and Hamas will be completely defeated and obliterated and destroyed. Then later on, we heard that the goals of the war were basically to destroy Hamas governing and military capabilities. Now, that's a lot different than there won't be Hamas, because if I just wanted to grind down capabilities, so if Hamas's capability on October 6th was the ability to fire, you know, thousands of rockets a day, and now the capability, to be honest, is to be able to fire three rockets a day. So you could say, okay, 99% of the Hamas capabilities have been destroyed. So you could say that. It may not be 100% accurate, but you could make an argument and say if the goal is to destroy capabilities, the capabilities have been mostly destroyed. Now, what about the governing capabilities? I think it's not clear that the governing capabilities have been destroyed because Hamas is still there. There's no evidence that when Israel leaves the neighborhood that some other group ever appears. It's just Hamas. Even in my estimation, I've always described Hamas as a kind of cross between a terrorist group and a mafia cartel. Hamas runs areas much like cartels in Colombia or whatever used to run places like Medellin or something. So because it's a mixed, Hamas is a multi-layered cake of what it is. Again, I think it depends on how you define victory. If Israel wants to change the kind of mission accomplished story and say, well, we defeated 90% of Hamas, we won, Israel's government can make that claim. I would not think that it's winning when you leave Gaza and the enemy controls the field of battle. Have you ever heard of a war in history in which the enemy controls the field of battle at the end of the day, and yet the other side that left claims victory? I think generally in history we would say it's not really victory.
Seth, it's been some days since here in the United States we've seen reports about the civilians. Much concerned, the use of the word famine was commonplace for weeks and weeks. The American-provided pier broke up in a storm, and then we're told it's reestablished itself. Is there a general understanding that the civilians are now being fed routinely? Is Hamas still interrupting supplies? That was part of the story earlier. What is the status of the civilians moving in and out of these neighborhoods?
Well, first of all, there are civilians in northern Gaza, hundreds of thousands of them. And then there's all the civilians that are in southern Gaza, including the IDPs that basically left the north. So I think the majority of Gazans, or maybe more than half, somehow are in the south. Many of them are IDPs from the north. Then you've got the people in the north. In the beginning of the war, because Israel had asked the million people in the north to leave, and the ones that remained behind really had nothing. I mean, very little services, very little food was getting in because borders were closed. I think those people did suffer, and I think that they were probably, there was probably a period where they were close to famine, depending on how you define it. Then, of course, a lot of aid poured into Gaza, and I think it's clear now that all those stories about famine were kind of being used either by Hamas or NGOs that are sympathetic to create a story in order to create a ceasefire. So that, like, we have to remember that a lot of things we hear about Gaza have an agenda. The agenda is to stop the war, and that's fine. I mean, from a humanitarian perspective, if you're a humanitarian, of course you'd like to have a ceasefire. Whether or not you exaggerate the conditions to get one is another question. I think it is exaggerated, but I would say that also we don't always know when food goes into Gaza. Usually the IDF will say, you know, 300 trucks crossed into Gaza yesterday or 1,000 last week or something. The food goes in, but where does it go? And I think the evidence is that it sits often on the other side of the border. The NGOs, for whatever reason, don't move it. They may claim that they are being attacked or it's not safe or who knows what. They never blame Hamas, by the way. They always just blame Israel. But I would say that it does seem in the interest of Hamas to not have that aid flowing so well, because then they can claim there's famine, then they can get the pressure to stop Israel's war. I would say generally we've not seen the evidence of the famine come out of the warnings about the famine, because usually the warnings are there could be famine. It's never that there necessarily actually is. And I think the evidence would show that in other conflicts like Sudan or other places, there actually really is you know, real dire needs that are, go beyond Gaza. But that would not be to say that the situation in Gaza is good. It's I think very difficult and disastrous. 9 months of people, you know, being stuck in a war zone or kids not getting to school. I mean, any basic things that people expect there. But I think, again, it's very hard to know the full story. And I think a lot of the organizations that work there are certainly biased. So that's why we get two sets of data. We get a data that Israel says this is what went in. And the organization is saying, yeah, but it didn't actually get to all these people. And then the same organization is saying that they don't even want, they're not able or want to deliver it, which makes it very difficult to then get to where you'd like to get, which is that the people get the food that actually gets into Gaza.
Because there's a two-front war, we mentioned Hezbollah. More than 2 weeks ago, it was on the eve of a catastrophe, a war with Hezbollah. That has not happened. Within these last hours, Seth, you filed a story about drone attacks against IDF soldiers in the north. What is the general thinking about the Hezbollah war? Has it been put on? Has it been postponed, or is it imminent?
Like that book, Waiting for Godot, or something. I mean, everyone in Israel is kind of waiting, but I think, and there's messaging about it, but I get the sense that that Israel's not going to go to war in Lebanon. But of course, Israel wants, you know, Hezbollah to take the threat seriously and would like to get the international community, get Hezbollah to withdraw from the border. On the other side of the coin, what we're seeing a lot of is a cyclical attempt by Hezbollah to escalate and de-escalate. So a few weeks ago, they escalated and they de-escalated. Then over the weekend, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Hezbollah fired dozens of rockets all over northern Israel, over Tzfat, and then they fired these drones that injured 18 soldiers yesterday. That was 17 lightly injured, one severely injured. So, you know, Hezbollah is just always poking and prodding, and then seeing Israel generally responds proportionally. So that's kind of where we are. However, I would say that what's interesting in the last few days is that Iranian messaging has changed on this. The Iranians, their acting foreign minister, reached out to his Turkish counterpart over the weekend and basically said or warned Israel with the Turks that you know, Israel should not go into Lebanon. And that's, I think, Iran trying to circle the wagons in the region against any kind of offensive. The Arab League also sent a delegate, a guy there to meet with all the parties in Lebanon, and they met with Hezbollah as well. And that all shows the Arab League is concerned about a war in Lebanon. We see lots of countries warning their citizens not to go. And we see the Iraqi-based Iranian-backed militias warning that they will attack the Americans if there's a war in Lebanon. So I think we're seeing a lot of rhetoric in the region where Iran is turning up the heat to try to prevent this conflict from growing. So that's where we are. Where it goes from here is not clear.
We're speaking with Seth Frantzman of the Jerusalem Post and the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Bill Raggio, of Senior Fellow for the Foundation, is also keeping the Long War Journal. And when we come back, Bill's question about the threat from the north and also a concern about the nature of success and failure in Gaza. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.